The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix Podcast. Tune in today.
Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
That's why you're going to Morrinsville to last represent the rural centre.
I'm going to Morrinsville because I'm an elitist Māori and I like to go to the most exclusive destinations, which is why I'm going to Morrinsville.
We've got time to record the whole thing because of the speed limit changes brought in by the Labour government.
That's right.
You'll be on the road for a while.
Well, she'll be just pulling into Morrinsville and there'll be someone changing the speed signs from 30 to 300. Now we're going. Tēnā koutou katoa, my name is Toby Manhire. It's the morning of Monday, November 27th, and there will be a buzz as we gather around Government House in Wellington as the ministers of a new National ACT New Zealand First Coalition, aka the Weet-Bix Coalition, are sworn in. With me in the studio, Ben Thomas. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
And somewhere...
I just got a text. I meant hello.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, good, good, Ben. That's way more appropriate.
Where are you, Bells?
I'm at the Gull Force 10, just off the Waikato Expressway, on my way to Morrinsville, one of my favourite destinations.
And the price of 95 is falling for all of New Zealand as we get back on track, even before your very eyes. The speed bumps are being removed from the roads.
$2.60.7.
Okay. Yeah. Pick us up some.
Will do.
On Friday, the two agreements that make up New Zealand's first fully-fledged three-party coalition were signed after 41 days since the election, during which Christopher Luxon, who will be Prime Minister probably about now, like any second now, sorted through the additives and the variances to scale his Big Rock Candy Mountain. There are, I've heard around the quarters, bits of Big Rock in the carpet, under the doors, floating in the pool. Sort of souvenirs, if you want any, from negotiations.
The key to a man like Christopher Luxon is that he can look at a Big Rock and see Michelangelo's David waiting to come out.
That's beautiful.
It's acts David.
Oh,
it's
wow.
It's David Seymour in the kind of the thick of my pose. Oh. And over 3 weeks of negotiations, they carefully chipped and chiselled it out.
Oh, my God, I think this is a whole bit in the making. Very grateful to, when we struggled around Big Rock, the listeners who helped us out, that it's a core concept in management consultancy. Ben, you wrote a column about that, and you actually very acutely picked up as well that Winston Peters, well, Christopher Luxon had those various kind of business self-help canons. Winston Peters was playing the rules. Is that what it's called, the rules?
Yeah, the rules. The sort of contemporary reference, it probably should have been like dating TikTok or trad wife or something.
Right.
But, yeah, the rules was a turn-of-the-century dating manual that, said, for when you're looking for Mr. Right, never answer the phone.
No.
If he tries to make a date with you within 2 days of the weekend, say, sorry, I'm washing my hair. And in fact, Winston Peters literally said that when he didn't turn up in Wellington, when Seymour and Luxon had flown down to meet him, he was getting a haircut.
He was at a barber on Ponsonby Road.
He was playing very closely to the rules.
Yeah, the rules say, don't say you're going to be in Wellington and then don't go to Wellington.
That's right. Treat him mean, keep him keen.
Before we get into the substance of the deals, and I will rattle through some bullet points in a moment, that stuff, the kind of dynamic between the three men. I don't know if both of you watched the press conference, but it was fascinating to me. We've got this kind of strange co-share arrangement, contiguous deputy leader, deputy prime minister arrangement that was the only way out, negotiated in some manner of coin toss or whatever. But in that presentation, that was in the banquet hall at the Beehive, and it struck me it was very much like an AGM, and the CEO was Christopher Luxon. He was cheerful and announcing some results. And then David Seymour was very much like the CFO and sort of enumerating the various wins and the personnel that were advanced. And Winston Peters was like a comment section on the internet. he got up there and he just wanted to litigate again the question of whether it was 40 days or 20 days, you know, and then he got into an argument with the press gallery.
Mathematical morons.
Mathematical morons.
There won't be any more Jessica Tover.
There won't be any more Jessica Tover. And that is, I mean, is that someone who is failing to take the opportunity to communicate, articulate the wins they've achieved? Or is that someone who's smarter than all that and is going, transcending all of that nonsense and speaking immediately to the people who just hate the media?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the wins that he achieved, and we'll get on to this, but there are some very significant policy wins in the New Zealand First Coalition Agreement. And then there are a lot of what I would call random cranky statements.
Rhetorical flourishes would be another way to put it.
Rhetorical flourishes, yeah. which really are just about a mood, right? You know, and we'll get onto this, but saying, oh, from now on, government departments will communicate primarily in English. Well, every government department communicates primarily in English, right?
Yeah. So New Zealand, English will be made an official language in New Zealand. It already is.
It already is. It's just not in the legislation, right? Yeah. But the legislation is in English, which is a bit of a clue. And but at the same, so part of communicating the wins, I think, is showing his followers that I'm not some, you know, little poodle or whatever for these other parties. Mm. I am setting the tone. I will be settling scores. Mm. You know, I think the best score settling in the agreements is a specific one saying that the no surprises rule in government, which is about, you know, information that agencies provide to the ministers, should be amended to take into account the privacy requirements for individuals, which is a direct callback to when his personal information about his superannuation was disclosed by officials to ministers. Like, just incredible detail to pettiness.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually good policy. You know, that's a good advancement. But you know, it is very
these
much
pointed,
about,
sort of salty little addendums, aren't they?
Yeah, and you've already seen it online. People who are, you know, they're like, oh, we're back. You know, the country's back, primarily in English. You know, and I think that, you know, that is a direct call out saying, you know, no more Tover, no more Jessica, no more of you talking heads on the media.
That was a real point in the particular parts of the internet, that whole thing. Annabelle, what did you make of the dynamic between these three men?
What struck me is, you know, when Winston said he was taking New Zealand back, I didn't realise he meant back to the 1970s. But, you know, obviously his supporters really loved it. It was interesting to watch the dynamics between him and Luxon. I think it put Luxon in a really awkward position. He wants to come across as an effective CEO type leader who's got all of his exec lined up, the T's and C's are all in there. He was there to roll them out. You know, he was very open about what the plan was. But Winston creating a sideshow makes him look like he's not really in charge. And he was sort of trying to interject and cool it down, but you can tell he's almost a little bit frightened to interject because that might send Winston off more or be perceived as rude. And in the meanwhile, you know, Seymour was trying to look like he was absolutely playing everything by the rules. So I saw someone describe them as the Hydra on Twitter the other day, and I think how those three personalities coexist in one government is going to be really interesting to watch.
It was amazing looking at the collection of photographs from various different outlets, including photographs on the social media accounts of those involved. There was seemed to be very, very few. There were a few, but almost all of them had one of the three, you know, with some expression of variously despair, distraction, fury. I don't know. You know, that's the nature of a class photo, right? There's always a bit of that, but there is some sense that it's, in a way, I think it's the third part that is the tricky one, while the other two are involved in some way. It's a huge test. And yeah, if Winston Peters is going to play thorn in the side from literally day one, have Christopher Luxon, as you say, Annabelle, go, okay, come on then, everybody around. What's it going to be like in a month? It also makes you... It's hard not to be sceptical about the way that the contiguous deputy prime ministers have been dealt out, insofar as if Winston Peters had been the second half, the second tranche, then you might say, oh, that's good that he'll be in there for the last. But he now vacates the deputy prime minister office. Yes, he'll still be foreign minister. Yes, he'll still be in cabinet. But that gives him more freedom to become, you know, to rip the handbrake from the chassis and start, you know, thwacking it around as he's wont to do.
And that halfway point is sort of where you start to see the coalition partners or the support parties really struggle often in the polls. So, you know, a number of people have made that observation, and I think it is well made, that there would be a bit more security, I think, for Luxon and the government as a whole, yep, were Winston to take that second shift.
But you do it month on, month off, you know? Or like, how do the Swiss do it? Anyway, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
8-day rotations, just to keep things interesting. Seymour, interesting, yeah. Again, very, very sort of very straightforward, very solid, very serious, as we saw him probably in the dying stages of the campaign. I actually think maybe he could stand to take a bit of a leaf out of Peter's book. Seymour was very popular as a politician. A lot of, you know, ACT's resurgence is totally down to Seymour and his leadership, you know, and a few things fell their way, but he capitalized on them. And it really is that leadership and his personality which has driven the resurgence of ACT into a you know, pretty serious player now and into government. But he seems to be, you know, with the exception of the sort of Weet-Bix comment recently, he's sort of, you know, he's kind of sanded off the edges a bit, you know, now that he's on the big stage. And I'm not sure it's working too well for him. You know, they got some, you know, he got some serious policy gains, and I think he would have wanted to, you know, foreground those rather than, you know, having a big song and dance or turning it into a circus. But I do hope he loosens up a bit, you know, for his own sake.
You mentioned the focus that they have on achieving wins for their supporters, and it seemed to me, in this arrangement, more than any so far in MMP, the parties have had at the front of their minds creating a deal that has a focus on the next election. Like, obviously that's always part of the calculation, but having a whole bunch of stuff, whether in substance or in that rhetorical material, that you can go back in 2026 and say, were it not for us, this is what we got.
Well, there's actually an interesting part in the coalition agreements where they're talking about who'll support what, and, you know, all the parties will support each other's agreements, and we'll all support National's fiscal plan, 100-point plan, or 100-day plan and 100-point plan.
100-day plan, 1,000-point economic plan, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, 1,000-point, sorry, yeah. And there's also a passage in there that says where there are policies that overlap, the other party may also claim this as a win for their policy.
Yep, exactly.
So clearly very much focused on who can take credit for
acknowledge
things.
And promote the word, something like that.
And so everyone's mind is on how do we make sure we don't get caught up in the slipstream and that people know that we delivered this for our voters.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Let me just go through some of the... I mean, there's a lot in there. Many of you will have read them from top to bottom. But let me just give a sort of summary. If you know everything, if you know it all already, fast forward by 30 or 45 seconds. But basically, each of ACT and New Zealand First get three cabinet ministers each. ACT gets four outside cabinet, New Zealand First three. As just touched on, it's important to remember that in both of these agreements, the 100-day plan that National released in the campaign and its fiscal plan and its, I think, 1,000-point economic plan are the kind of default foundation. So if they're not expressly contradicted or ruled out in any of these agreements, then they become the policy program for this term of government. National's foreign buyer tax goes, because that's been the way it's described. In fact, the foreign buyer access goes is more to the point. So that leaves New Zealand First able to say that we won't have foreign buyers back in the property market. It also leaves a bit of a gap as far as revenue is concerned. One of the ways that tax gap is being filled is because there is also the repeal, thanks principally to New Zealand First and Bit 2 Act, of smoke-free legislation, which means there'll be more excise coming in from tobacco. ACT gets its regulation minister and the red tape reduction policy pushed through. New Zealand First gets like a shaved down and redefined version of the Provincial Growth Fund. $1.2 billion for infrastructure, regional infrastructure fund. There will be the Treaty Principles Bill, which ACT had wanted to win a referendum on, will be supported through to Select Committee. As we know, that you have your first reading, then Select Committee, then second reading, then third reading, and off you go into law. It means that only up to Select Committee will be supported by the Coalition. There it will mean that there will be a kind of version of an inquiry insofar as the Select Committee will scrutinise the legislation as it is and will have submissions, and it will get some of the stuff, but it won't get the referendum. Partnership schools / charter schools reintroduced. New Zealand First gets its inquiry into COVID-19. We already have an inquiry into COVID-19, but they want it to be public, which will be interesting. They also want to look at things like vaccine efficacy and procurement, which is obviously a play to a particular constituency. Light rail in Auckland is gone. Let's Get Wellington Moving is gone. There is a particular requirement that, quote, reduce expenditure on cycleways. The ban on pseudoephedrine is gone,
yes,
which I think is the one that just about everyone will be happy. A very unorthodox, quite specific, $6 million a year in this incredible helicopter view big picture coalition deals. $6 million a year for Mike King's Gumboot Friday charity. The restoration of interest deductibility for landlords will be sped up. The pendulum swings back towards landlords more generally in terms of things like notice periods. Tightening the screws on beneficiaries, more funds for IRD tax audits. The Therapeutic Products Act will be repealed. Some movements towards a 4-year term referendum on that. Everyone wants that. ACT has won a big one for a part of its support, a review of the firearms registry and rewrite, I think, is the verb of the Arms Act. There are culture war wins across the board, some of which we touched on. There's one on the curriculum, refocus the curriculum on academic achievement and not ideology, including the removal and replacement of the gender, sexuality and relation-based education guidelines. Whether or that form that takes will be interesting. Fees-free goes from year one to final year. Select Committee inquiry on banking competition. Every single party is taking credit for repealing the clean car discount, scrapping the Māori Health Authority and fair pay agreements, among other things. And another one that I don't know, I quite like for some reason, that ACT notes in its thing that National will not be proceeding with its taxpayer receipt. You know, that thing, which is just like that felt like we need a policy for tomorrow. Has anybody got anything? What about everyone gets a receipt for their tax? It's like, that's gone. We're going to put a line through that. I quite like that. I don't know. I'm interested to hear what you all think of that. There's obviously lots to talk about, and there's lots that I haven't included in there too. Did I mention there's that kind of going through all the legislation, looking for references to the treaty? That's another one. We'll come back to that in a second. Quickly on tax. Ben, there's some gaps there. We're going to have a fiscal update, and we're going to have a mini budget before Christmas. Time is running short. Nicola Willis has said she is emphasising the mini. She's like, it's basically become nano now, I think, a nano budget before Christmas. Are you expecting to see more stuff, them have to reconfigure or sort of put a line through other stuff in their plans in order to deal with the opening of the books?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the fiscal plan as presented by National, obviously you take out the foreign buyers tax, arguments aside over, you know, its potential effectiveness, that leaves a $700 million nominal hole each year, and you know, and once you start totting up, you know, regional infrastructure funds, well, that doesn't so much count in the operating expenditure. That'll be capital expenditure, but it's still a cash.
Yeah.
That's still a cash expense. It's still money the government spends. It doesn't all add up, right? Or it's not likely to add up. Nicola Willis has said correctly that they did leave buffers, you know, for our contingencies in their fiscal plan, pretty tight ones, buffers. But, you know, buffers nonetheless. And we've already seen that the coalition agreements aren't the whole story. There were a couple of things mentioned, I think, by Luxon on Friday or Saturday, such as getting rid of the raising the threshold for abatement for working for families, yep, for the in-work tax credit, which means if you're marginally employed, part-time worker, parent, you would get working for families to encourage you back into the workforce. That benefit starts abating pretty steeply once you reach a certain level, and that level is not that many hours this week per week with the rise of the minimum wage and inflation. So the idea was to give a bit more headroom. That's gone now. If you ask all the parties, you know, do you think it's important that people who aren't in full time work, you know, do get back into the workforce as parents, they'd probably say yes. You know, a bit of an inconsistency there, but look, you know, there will be sacrifices that they have to make. I'm sure that there'll be a raft of other things that are on the list, that may currently be regarded as sort of promises or policies that are probably going to be on the chopping block to make that the mini budget add up in the short term.
Annabelle, looking at it, in the round, there are quite a few references to issues around governance, obviously, which all three parties are dead against. But also, except when it comes to certain configurations, like Kohanga Reo and or whatever. But what's your looking at it in the whole? What is the message to Māori in these deals?
I think it comes across as an assault on every aspect of Māori society, from health to education to justice to Oranga Tamariki. I mean, Oranga Tamariki was compelled to, to devolve power to iwi and to place Tamariki within their whānau hapū iwi. When you think back about what was happening in the early 2000s when there were lots of high-profile child abuse cases, and people would be screaming from the mountaintop, why aren't Māori leaders stepping up and resolving this problem and blah, blah, blah. And now that something iwi had always wanted to do, and since then iwi have like got themselves in a position where they have resourced themselves and worked with Oranga Tamariki to resource themselves to care for their own tamariki, so we're not getting a repeat of what we've seen in the historical state abuse inquiry, where you have generations of kids scooped up, abused in state care, then put into jail for an apprenticeship in crime, and then becoming like hardened gang members and all the rest of it. Now that iwi are in a position to care for their own tamariki as requested, they're getting rid of it. So, or, you know, the admissions policy. Tama Pōtaka during the election campaign talked about max kāwanatanga and wanting to get rid of max kāwanatanga. Now we have 28 ministers and the government is telling universities what their admissions policy should be when it comes to encouraging Māori and Pacifica students to enter into medicine. So, you know, justice, three strikes, everywhere you look, this government is going to have a huge impact on every aspect of Māori society.
Yeah, I think it's totally right that the overall tone is a big middle finger. You know, whether it's just to Māori or whether it's to the establishment, you know, the greenstone carving wearing, what is it, shiny bottoms or whatever Winston Peters calls them. And, you know, it's definitely the most regressive policy platform that we've seen, in terms of Māori, probably ever.
Yeah.
In terms of rolling things back, certainly, yeah. Probably since the, you know, 20, you know, the repeal of Te Uruwera District Native Reserve Act in 1921. But the most interesting thing is a lot of it's just microaggressions. You know, it is these things that, a lot of it are things that won't have, you know, this is not, there are plenty that is substantive in there, but there are all these sorts of things like, you know, the primary language has to be English and changing back Māori names and, and it's almost just a sort of nasty, busybody sort of thing that, you know, where you're really sort of like, yeah, like the enrollment scheme for medical school, you sort of think, is this what the government needs to be concerned with? This kind of micromanagement of etiquette, essentially, in a lot of cases. And I hold out some diminishing optimism for some of these things in terms of, you know, there are actually, you know, some issues that could be profitably addressed, I think, by the government. You know, I think, you know, the idea of reviewing every treaty clause in all legislation where it exists. And I read that slightly differently to, I think, how RNZ talked about it this morning as removing treaty clauses from most legislation. That's not what I got from the policy. It was reviewing it to either provide a specific
To make it specific to that legislation so it wasn't generic.
Yeah, which is a trend for new legislation since 2015, where the idea is that the Crown will, you know, in partnership and consultation with Māori, will decide how the principles are expressed through the law and then they will write that down. Now, that will actually be a really interesting exercise because if you go through and look at, say, the Conservation Act or the Resource Management Act or something, Tama Pōtaka was the chief executive of Ngāi Tāiki Tāmaki when they won some extremely significant court victories in terms of enumerating what those rights were. So I don't think it's a matter of either deleting or codifying where the rights exist. And that's first of all, it's a huge undertaking. I don't think they'll get very far on it. But second of all, it actually risks putting into legislation, you know, risks from a New Zealand First point of view, putting into legislation rights that they think are arguable or they disagree with. So it'll be really interesting because the person who's steering a lot of this work is Tama Pōtaka, who's a National Party MP, who's got an iwi, a background in post-settlement iwi, who is not an actor in New Zealand First MP, and so I'm really interested to see how it plays out.
Yeah, just so to clarify, it says conduct a comprehensive review of all legislation except when it is related to or substantive to existing full and final treaty settlements that includes, quote, the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, end quote, and replace all such references with specific words relating to the relevance and application of the treaty or repeal the references. You're right, so it could end up being more detailed and more substantive. That comes, Annabelle, directly after a another bullet point in the New Zealand First National Agreement, which is amend the Waitangi Tribunal legislation to refocus the scope, purpose and nature of its inquiries back to the original intent of that legislation. So it falls part as part of this general push, particularly from New Zealand First, against what they consider to be overreach by the Waitangi Tribunal and by the judiciary in general, right, into these things.
Well, the irony is that that's what's in the Waitangi Act, is for the tribunal to investigate breaches of treaty principles. And I was talking to a treaty lawyer the other night who warned that the review itself could be subject to a treaty claim.
Right.
It almost certainly will be.
Yeah, if it doesn't include Māori. So, I mean,
springtime for lawyers.
It really is, you know, like the people who are going to benefit most from what's happening at the moment is actually lawyers. The other irony is that, you know, in terms of the whole two laws for all argument and making, you know, one law for all, where there genuinely are two laws for all, this coalition agreement is silent. Where there's two laws in play is things like Māori land, where Māori land can be locked up in perpetual leases forever and a day, completely unfairly, and for peppercorn rentals. There's nothing about that. There's nothing about releasing the thousands of acres of Māori land that Māori are currently being deprived of because they're subject to perpetual leases. There's nothing about the tens of thousands of acres of Māori land all around the country that Māori are literally physically locked out of because they're completely landlocked.
Great recent episode of Mata, which touched on some of those issues that I think you can watch on TVNZ online.
That's right, TVNZ Plus. Thank you, Ben. You can watch it on TVNZ Plus or YouTube.
That's Mata. or as we call it now, Matters.
That's why it matters.
As you now go and continue your journey into rural matters, you're refocused.
Can I say, I was interested to see Paula Goldsmith as the Minister of Treaty Settlements again. The Minister of Treaty Settlements. And I had a little look through his Wikipedia page and saw that he has a black belt and Taekwondo, and I thought, I cannot think of a more perfect qualification to get the Ngāpuhi settlement done than having a black belt and Taekwondo. So I'm very excited to see what happens there.
He's also, what iwi was he affiliated to by Nikki Kay?
Ngā Te Porou.
Ngā Te Porou.
His great-grandfather, who was it's like, you know, like, was it 10% of the world's population is descended from Genghis Khan? Yeah. And it's like about 20% of
Near
New
enough.
Zealanders descended
Near
from
enough.
Paul Goldsmith.
Near
like
enough.
Absolute player, great-grandfather.
Ngāti Ipsum. All right. I think we got heaps more to talk about, and we will do so in the future. But let's wrap it up there and say good luck out there in Morrinsville, Annabelle.
Thank you. Don't be jealous. Not everyone gets to spend time in Morrinsville.
Good luck out there, Ben and Wellington. Thank you, Samuel. Thank you, members. Don't forget to look at our Pledge Me thing for our cool new campaign. Kia ora.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spin-Off. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spin-Off member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spin-Off Podcast Network.